And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson. North Shore Health Centers is a nonprofit committed to providing quality, affordable health care for all in Porter, Lake, LaPorte, and Jasper counties. With over 20 locations offering medical, dental, visual, chiropractic, and mental health and medication assistance, including after hours and urgent care, North Shore Health Centers serves both scheduled and walk-in patients. Joining us now to discuss more about how this healthcare center has a dedicated team, which includes primary care doctors, specialists, and support staff focused on addressing your complete health, is Gervais Dickerson, the Director of Community Engagement. Gervais, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. So, Gervais, North Shore Health Centers has officially begun phase one of opening new clinics across the region. I want you to take a moment to share with our listening audience where the new locations are, as well as the vast amount of services that are provided, including dental care, chiropractic care, and even patient-centered medical home care.
So, North Shore Health Centers, we're a nonprofit. We're committed to providing quality, affordable health care in Porter, Lake, LaPorte, and Jasper County. Currently, we have over 20 locations, which those locations will be Portage, Lake Station, Chesterton, Crown Point, DeMont, East Chicago, Gary, Maryville, Hammond, LaPorte, Michigan City, and also in Valparaiso, we have an obstetrical and gynecological associate facility there. So those are all of our locations throughout the region.
Sounds like you do, in fact, cover the entire region, having centers in Lake Porter and LaPorte County, so that it's exciting. Now, Gervais, I should have actually started our conversation, so I want to go back and start with this because I think it's quite important. Share with our listening audience, what is the mission of North Shore Health Centers?
Our mission is to provide the most comprehensive and quality health care without exclusion to everyone, every time. That is very important. We're here to provide quality medical care, dental care. We have so many different services that people are able to come to. We also have on-site pharmacies as well at a lot of our facilities. So we're genuinely here to make sure that everyone is getting the care that they need.
Gervais, North Shore Healthcare Centers is a leading provider of comprehensive, again, affordable healthcare and has a wide range of family care physicians and psychiatrists. And I want to talk a little bit about that affordability, right? So North Shore offers a sliding scale based on income for those with no medical insurance who qualify. Can you take a moment to speak more about this and how it ensures that everyone in the region has access to healthcare?
So yes, we do. We have a sliding scale. So individuals can come in. We have individuals called navigators that can sit down and meet with them. Some people may actually qualify for insurance, and they may not even realize it. So we do have individuals that can talk with them, that can take their information and see what services or what insurance they may actually qualify to receive services. We do the sliding scale, but again, no one is turned away. We want to make sure that everyone is included, and they're able to take part in all of our services. Those services will be chiropractic. We have dental services. We have endocrinology, family practice, OBGYN. We have optometry, pediatrics, podiatry. We have behavioral health services, substance abuse. We also have a weight loss management program as well, and then the women's health program. We also provide educational classes to the community and to our patients. And then we have a community relations team also that is out in the community regularly educating the community on what we do at North Shore, the services we provide, and how they can be a part of it. And we also have a 340B pharmacy, and that's a discounted pharmacy as well.
That is exciting. And I'm going to go back and just say that it warms my heart to hear you share at the start of our conversation, just to hear you share that there are professionals on site at each of your locations that are help those that may not even think that they qualify for healthcare insurance, apply for healthcare insurance. That is so important. And it's not something that you hear quite often when you think about healthcare centers. That's a great opportunity for our listening audience to take advantage of that. Now, I want to take a moment to have you share with our listening audience more about some of the doctors and their approach to care, because it's quite unique when you think about medical care in this particular region. So share more about the care that the doctors provide.
So our doctors at North Shore, they want to take the total person. And that's why I think it's so key. I am also a patient of North Shore myself. And to be able to go to the facility and to receive care for everything that I need. I'm not running around to different locations to take care of this need, or if I need to have an x-ray done, or if our patients need to have other services done. They're really able. It's not like a one-stop shop of medical care. Also, your doctors have access to all of your medical information. So that way, they're able to look into the system. They're able to see if you're having behavioral health services, they're able to see what's happening there. If you've gone to the optometrist, they're able to see what's happening there. So they can tie it all together to make sure we're taking care of the total person, the total body, the total being.
Gervais, I want to talk about the 2024-2025 school year, because for a lot of us here in the region, the school year will kick off in just a few days. And you think about that checklist that parents get, right? They get this checklist of things that they need to do, including orientation, including picking up school supplies. But a lot of parents will need to get their students immunizations and or physicals. And the reason that I bring this up is because I found it quite interesting that you guys have pretty free, pretty open, quick appointment availability. So spend a few minutes speaking more about that.
Yes, absolutely. So we know that this could be a very, very busy time for parents when they're trying to get their children in to be seen, to get physicals done. Sometimes they need sports physicals. Also, dental appointments is a lot of times when parents are trying to make sure that they have those dental appointments, because generally you want children to come in at once every 6 months unless there's more care that's needed for dental. So this is a time where they can get the appointment scheduled. They can actually go to our website to schedule appointments very quickly. They can also call. But I think it's such an awesome advantage to be able to go right to the website, because we know everything now is done through social media.
Absolutely.
But they can go right on the website and actually pick the facility that they want to go to and get their kids scheduled and get themselves scheduled as well. A lot of times as parents, we forget about taking care of ourselves. So this is a time where the family can go and get their appointment scheduled and see their doctors and make sure that everybody, because preventative care is key.
So Gervais, I want to talk to you because we have you here today to talk about a big, exciting week-long of events that North Shore Health Centers will participate in observance of National Health Centers Week. So can you take a moment to share with our listening audience what you guys have planned?
Absolutely. So National Health Centers Week, it is an opportunity to highlight the commitment to all the community agencies or the community healthcare facilities nationally. This year, it is August 4th through August 10th. And so what we will be doing is, now, I want to go back just a little bit. Currently, families are able to go, or parents are able to go to our facilities and get backpacks with school supplies for their children. They do not have to have an appointment in order to get those. We know how important it is for a family to be able to get backpacks and the school supplies for their kids. During National Health Centers Week, we will also be providing those at every single facility throughout the week. It's a part of our way of just giving back to the community. We will also be doing on-site job interviews. One thing about actually coming into the region with the facilities that we have, it is also providing a lot of job opportunities. So we will be doing on-site interviews during National Health Centers Week at all of our sites during that entire week, because we want people to be able to come from their city and gain employment in their city. So that's just the pride of being from the region and actually being able to get a job as well.
That is so exciting to take that opportunity to, again, add to the economic development of the entire region by, of course, adding more jobs, providing quality health care, but that added benefit of adding more jobs. I think that is so exciting that you guys are doing those on-site interviews.
We are doing our grand opening, our ribbon cutting on August 28th for our Crown Point location. That one will be at 11:30. So anyone who wants to come out, it is a beautiful, beautiful facility. Come take, we'll have tours and like snacks that day. So it's going to be an awesome time just to come and tour the facility. There's no obligation. Just come and have a good time with us.
Gervais, I have about a minute or so left. And before I let you go, I want you to, again, share with our listening audience how they can find out more about North Shore Health Centers, including how they can go online to make appointments, etc.
NorthShoreHealth.org is our website. There's information on there about the different services we provide. It gives a little bit more detail. Also, you can schedule an appointment. Just pick the site that you want to go to, and you can, for any service, directly on our website. Also, we are on Facebook, we are on Instagram, so different social media platforms. But in order to make your appointment, go directly to our website. Also, you can give us a phone call. But I always say the website is so cool because you can actually go, you don't feel pressured, and you can take your time, read through what's there, the information is there, get more information, more details about our site, and the services, and then you can make your decision from there. We want everybody to just have, you know, to be healthy and to be taken care of and to be well. So that's why we're here.
Gervais Dickerson is the Director of Community Engagement with North Shore Health Centers. Again, Gervais, thank you for spending time with us on Regionally Speaking, sharing all of the information that your healthcare center provides across the region.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being here.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
Joining us now on the studio line, Northwest Indiana business reporter and local author Joseph Peet, to discuss his latest book, Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. Joe, welcome back to Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
As I flip through the book here that we got to our studios just a few days ago, I was really, really taken back, I think, by just the amount of stories that can be told about East Chicago and the Indiana Harbor. What gave you the idea to go ahead and collect all these stories and put them into the form of a book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so I had read in Lost Time in Indiana for the History Press previously, and they have a Lost series of books. Jerry Davich with the Times also wrote Lost Gary, but they have books like this for cities all over the country. They had asked me to do another book about Northwest Indiana, and initially I was thinking about doing a book about the steel mills, which I've covered extensively. And I was starting to do, but over the years, everyone said, I got a lot of suggestions over, like, what my next book should be. People know I like to write about the history. I got a lot of suggestions for East Chicago over the years, so that was kind of in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. But I initially started researching a book about the steel mills at the, and I was doing some research at the Chicago Public Library, but I was just struck by all the stories of the community, everything that was just notable about the community. Hearing these stories about, you know, the warm, nostalgic feelings people have about growing up in Indiana Harbor. I mean, although the city does have some urban problems like pollution and political corruption and things like that, people just have a very, just a glowing sense of, like, what it was like to grow up in such a diverse place with so many different nationalities from all over the world, where different languages and different cuisines are served on every block. And people are just kind of, like, united. Everyone's dad, you know, worked at the steel mill. Everyone was kind of on the same footing. It kind of, like, really brought together people and gave people a sense of camaraderie. I was just really struck by that and impressed by that. So I kind of pivoted away from doing a book about, I plan to revisit that later, but I pivoted away from doing a book about just the steel mills and decided to write about one of the steel towns. And, you know, there's so much about East Chicago is just fascinating. I really view it as a microcosm of America. It's where people came from all over the world to pursue opportunity. You had, you had over 100 nationalities at one point. They, you know, built up mighty steel mills there that just drew people, you know, from all over the world. It was, you know, a lot of families' first entrance into America. And its fortunes kind of right rose and fell with the steel mills. But it was just this incredible melting pot that people still tell fun stories about.
Joe, where is the Indiana Harbor for folks who either A, have never been there, or B, maybe they're not here in Northwest Indiana listening to this conversation today?
Oh, sure, absolutely. East Chicago is known as the Twin City. It is not like a Twin Cities like Minneapolis or St. Paul are two separate cities. It's two distinct neighborhoods in the same city, but originally they had a very different character. There was they're basically separated. You had the Indiana Harbor portion where it's on Lake Michigan. It's near where the Cleveland Cliffs Works steel mill is. It's kind of built around that. It's between Klein and but it's separated from the traditional Indiana Harbor portion of the city, which they're only accessible by a couple different roads. They're divided by the ship canal and the railroad lines, and they were initially like two very different parts. The Indiana Harbor part was traditionally where a lot of the immigrants would locate, It was close to the steel mills. There was a little bit more pollution. It was a little more dense and more urban. A lot of more housing, like, on the same block. The traditional East Chicago part was a little bit more suburban in character. That's where, like, City Hall is. It's, you know, Main and Indianapolis Boulevard. The city does have two downtowns, but people think of the East Chicago downtown as the one with Casablanca, you know, City Hall, and the Bomb Shop, and so forth. And that was historically it was kind of the more sort of genteel suburban area was the East Chicago proper. And for a long time, one of the things my book explores is they had the great Roosevelt-Washington divide where the two sides were the two sides each had their high school. They had a big basketball rivalry. The basketball was like everything in the community. It was the place to be on Friday night. They produced a lot of highly. It was the only city in the state where they had back-to-back undefeated national champions from two different high schools. It's the only city in the entire country where they had two players who were both played in both the Final Four and in the World Series. It produced like a lot of great athletes: Junior Bridgman, Greg Popovich, Tim Stoddard, just a ton of people. And largely, it was kind of honed by that. That rivalry. It was one of the great basketball cities in Indiana for a long time, and many people are nostalgic about, you know, Hale Noble Washington or Roosevelt, or depending on which side of the city they were from. So it was a friendly rivalry, but it was there was a definitely strong sense of identity depending on where in the city you grew up in, where you went to high school, and it partly reflected kind of those class and ethnic divides and so forth.
Speaking of basketball, and I should note really quick, you've got like five straight chapters dedicated to Washington, Roosevelt, Washington, Roosevelt, Washington. So if that tells you anything about the rivalry there, Michael Jordan makes a mention in your book as well in chapter 23. I don't want to give away the full story, of course, but why is Michael Jordan in a book about East Chicago?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, he played his first game in a Bulls uniform at Washington High School. He was the city had recruited the Bulls to play a preseason game because Ulysses Bridgman was playing for the Bucks at the time, and he was a big hometown star, and they're looking to host a Bucks Bulls game. It was just a basketball crazed town at the time, still too. But they arranged to have the Bulls come in and to play. So the first time he ever suited up was for the Bulls was in East Chicago, and he was very stellar. He got in a couple dunks. I interviewed several people who were there. They kind of recounted their memories. With my previous history book, a lot of it was kind of focused on, you know, the primary sources, newspaper articles, you know, whatever I could dig up from the archives. This has all that too. Old Inland, you know, magazines and things of that nature. But this book is heavily based on interviews with people who grew up in and lived in East Chicago and Indiana Harbor, and kind of sharing their memories of, special occasions like the Jordan's first game with the Bulls. And one thing that I was surprised in researching it was just how many sort of notable people either hailed from East Chicago, mm-hmm. where, I mean, you have like the ABC newsman, Frank Reynolds, or Phil Ponce, the great television journalist, or, you know, the Medal of Honor winning Emilio De La Garza, a lot of firsts in the state with, the first, Latino elected official, the first Latino company, the longest running Latino company in the Midwest, things of that nature. But then you also had a lot of great people that had some kind of connection to the city, like Stevie Wonder spent part of childhood growing up there. The Jackson family, before they moved to Gary, they lived in East Chicago. There was a lot of notable people have some connection. It was, it produced people like Betsy Palmer, who played, most known today for playing playing Jason Voorhees' mother in Friday the 13th. But she was like a major actor who was known for all her television and movie roles and the golden age of Hollywood. And it was the city, it was a difficult life in the city for many because it was long hours in the steel mills. It was hard work. It was, but it managed to kind of forge a lot of like greatness and just all kinds of different endeavors, whether science fiction books or athletics or art or tattooing. You had the first tattoo shop founded in Chicago, started by an East Chicagoan. There was just so much. East Chicago people have just gone on to accomplish so much in the world.
So along with all of those famous names, one famous name that actually isn't a person, of course, is the Titanic. And correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, the Titanic never actually set sail in Lake Michigan. And, of course, it sunk in the Atlantic Ocean. So what tie does the Titanic have to East Chicago?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great it's like the Unsalted, where they point out there's like Michigan's still shark-free. But unfortunately there was a tragic connection to it where there was a resident who sailed over on the Titanic to East Chicago, and he was he sailed over with his sister and his sister's child, and the sister and the child didn't make it. He did survive, but he went on to live in East Chicago with his family. They sailed over from Sweden, I believe. But it was just remarkable. I just found when researching it, like how much history has some sort of East Chicago connection. But it was, it was one of the many East Chicago immigration stories where they were in, they were coming over from Sweden, and they just happened to pick the worst possible boat. And he would tell stories about it to his family for the rest of his life. And it was just unfortunate that he made it, but his rest of his family did not.
Really a tragic story there. But there, again, a lot of stories talking, like you said, about Catherine Holm, talking about the East Chicago Hermit, learning all about, of course, the slice of life, along with parades and holiday parties. The Pastrick Machine, of course, that's in reference to former East Chicago Mayor Robert Pastrick, who was in charge for decades and really the main cog in the machine, if you will, with regards to what we know as the Democratic Machine. What kind of a role did Pastrick play, not only on East Chicago politics, but region politics as a whole?
Oh, absolutely. Well, Pastrick even had like a national influence. He was kind of considered like a kingmaker at times. Anytime like Robert Kennedy or some notable politician would pass through, they would, they'd have to pay a visit to Pastrick. But for a long time, East Chicago was the center of the Democratic Party in, Lake County. It was kind of considered, you were either from East Chicago or you wanted to be. And it was kind of the center of power, partly because of the machine politics. But that was one thing about the one thing that was notable about the book. There have been other like great books about, Archibald McKinley wrote Twin City, Jay Madison wrote East Chicago for Arcadia Publishing. There have been many good books about East Chicago. It's been a while since it's been a general purpose one. But the city is so rich with stories. Like you could literally just do a book about the politics. You could do a book about the pollution. You could do a book about all these different intersecting issues. It would be worthy of like books on their own. But Pastrick was, he was the subject of documentaries like The King of Steel Town, and he was, subject to scrutiny from the FBI and federal officials for years and years. And he was never convicted, but he was finally brought down by the sidewalk scandal in which multiple city officials ended up being convicted of basically selling paving of sidewalks and sidewalk repairs for vote, exchanging them for votes, and it brought down a lot of people. One of the councilmen fled to Greece, where his family was from, and they have no extradition policy if he happens to be of Greek ancestry, and he's still there now, unless he passed away. But they were known for, it was a big vote center in the state back, and it was also big in the state at the time when a lot of statewide elections used to be more competitive, Indiana governors like Frank O'Bannon and Evan Bayh and so forth. And Pastrick was respected throughout the state and turned to throughout the state for being able to drive turnout being able to drive turnout in East Chicago, obviously, but in Lake County. And it was kind of that Chicago-style machine politics where they would, they would just bring out the numbers. And he ruled for decades and decades amid all kinds of change in the city, but he did things to kind of safeguard the city for the future, you know, bringing in the casino and the marina and all kinds of different developments is kind of the steel job faded. But politics were a big part of the city's history, and you can still go in some quarters and still see Patrick for mayor signs hanging in some windows.
Yeah, speaking of Robert Patrick, of course, so important and vital to the city of East Chicago. His name actually makes an appearance in the front right corner of the book, Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. We're talking with the author, Joe Peet, who is also, you might know him as, the Times of Northwest Indiana business reporter, an award-winning reporter, I might add, Joe. Let's fast forward a couple of decades here. Of course, one of the biggest stories to come out of East Chicago in the last couple of years, of course, was the West Calumet Housing Project and the Kerry Ghosh Elementary School. Of course, that is the lead contamination crisis, and that's still a story that really has not yet been finished. It's not been completed. There are still people living in East Chicago who have suffered the health consequences of that lead-contaminated soil in that area. What can you tell us about that section of the book?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's because the series as a whole is supposed to be about kind of bygone places like, you know, the bygone downtown, Indiana Harbor, jewelry stores, you know, Mademoiselle Shop, Hot Dog John's, Taco Joe's. People, places family remember, that's like the general gist of it. But the thing is, with the environmental issues in East Chicago, they're just so notable and so pressing, it's impossible to ignore. So I kind of had to touch upon some of that and address some of that in the book. That in and of itself could really be its own book, because there's this legacy of industrial pollution. Like, industry really helped build up East Chicago. It peaked at around 60,000 people, but it really drove the economy. It, you know, led to all the development. It, you know, a lot of people from East Chicago spread further across Northwest Indiana too. So it really helped drive the region as a whole. But the cost of that and the price of that was that there was an incredible amount of industrial pollution, air, water, soil. You know, you had a lot of haze over East Chicago. Indiana Harbor section had kind of an acrid smell from the steel mills for a long time. There was a famous instance in the 1950s, I believe it was, when a Chicago Tribune reporter stuck his hand in Lake Michigan in Indiana Harbor, and it came back out completely covered in black tar. You know, before there was an EPA, there was just a widespread amount of pollution, and that led to the kind of the ticking time bomb of the lead crisis that attracted a lot of national attention, particularly after Flint, because it had so many similarities to the Flint lead crisis. But the basically resulted in the closure of the elementary school Kerry Ghosh, and the led to the West Calumet neighborhood entirely being, you know, razed, and an entire neighborhood of people was just relocated over, you know, shut down. The homes were torn down. They're relocated overnight. It's being like turned into light industrial development now. Something that's not going to have like a warehouse or logistics. It's something that's not going to have that pollution. But just hundreds of people were just immediately told they're going to have to leave their homes. And there are just unsafe levels of lead in the soil. But that's unfortunately part of the tragic, industrial legacy in the city, where you have all kinds of compounding environmental problems, where it's not, you know, that obviously was a crisis because it can really affect brain development. You know, children in particular are strongly susceptible to even small trace amounts of lead can really impact their development and hurt them neurologically. But they, East Chicago's just dealt with all kinds of, you know, spills into Lake Michigan, toxic emissions, air quality problems. It still has, you know, some of the worst air quality in the state. It has a lot of, environmental problems to this time. It's part of the issue, too, with redevelopment, even at a time when development's booming in the region, is you have kind of sites where it's going to need some type of environmental cleanup, which kind of will deter some investors and things like that. Mm-hmm. But communities for generations have had to live with the toxic legacy of these companies.
Joe, as we wrap up our conversation about your book, Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor, before I get into sort of the final thoughts, final question, where can folks find the book and maybe get out and meet you?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, the book, it's available at local bookstores like Miles Books and Highland, Green Door Books and Hobart, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. Basically, any local bookstore is going to have it. I'm going to be doing some signings coming up at Miles Books on July 20th, Green Door Books on July 28th, and Paul Henry's Art Gallery in Hammond on August 3rd, I believe. But I'll be out doing book signings, and then I usually give talks to different historic societies, so I'll be out and around discussing the book.
And, of course, the final comment here, we talk about current East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland. Copeland said, quote, "It's a beautiful thing. People get a twinkle in their eyes when they remember it. Those who grew up here and left often can't find it anywhere else." This book hits a lot on the nostalgia of East Chicago, but as we look forward now, we're in 2024 and moving forward through the next few years, maybe the next few decades, what does the future look like for East Chicago?
East Chicago does seem to be kind of on the upswing. You know, it's been a rough past few decades, but they are making the progress. Like the kind of final chapter looks a lot of the initiatives of the Copeland administration, things they're doing to kind of stabilize the housing, and they've, you know, torn down and replaced a lot of the public housing in the city already. They're doing things like trying to bring in a new team to Block Stadium. There's been some, you know, investments been coming to the city. There's been, you know, they're diversifying the industrial base beyond just steel mills. But there's been the number of, you've seen a lot of, like, I've covered a lot of new business openings there for the time. You've seen a lot of, like, restaurants and retail businesses have come back. The downtown areas are still pretty strong. The city does have, certainly has its challenges. It has challenges that are common with any kind of rust belt area or any kind of urban area, and those do affect it. However, you know, they've been making progress on environmental cleanup. They've been cleaning up the Grand Calumet River, was one of the most polluted in the country. They've been doing cleanups to the point where, you know, you have hawks and herons and you have all kinds of birds and fish returning. And, you know, progress is being made in a number of fronts. And, you know, it kind of ends kind of on an optimistic note. You know, there's, you see definite signs of seeds being planted that are starting to germinate in East Chicago.
Joseph Pete, Northwest Indiana Times business reporter, of course, an award-winning reporter, I might add, and author, joining us here on Originally Speaking, discussing Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. Joe, thank you so much for your time today to go ahead and discuss your newest book. And what's the next page turner we should be looking out for?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm working on another one for Reedy Press, which is my other publisher. It's Lost Treasures of Indiana. It's a statewide one. For all my books up to this point, I focused on Northwest Indiana. They asked me to do one that was kind of about more of Indiana as a whole. It does, of course, have a lot of Northwest Indiana stories in it, though, because that's where I'm from and that's what I try to capture and represent and, you know, so forth. But it takes a more statewide approach to kind of bygone buildings and institutions and sports stadiums and things across the state. So I'm working on that for them now, and I'm not sure exactly when that's going to come out, but it'll be out sometime in a year or two.
Well, we're looking forward to that. But until then, we've got Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. Joe Pete, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
The state of the economy remains a focus for Americans, especially with the U.S. presidential national conventions underway this summer. More than $3.4 trillion in individual tax and estate tax cuts are set to expire in 2025, with the end of several provisions from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. As Americans anticipate what significant tax changes could mean for their financial well-being, now is the time for Americans to prepare their finances for the second half of the year. When it comes to the expiration of the TCJA, Developing a plan now could provide significant tax savings for you and your heirs in the years ahead. Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer is with us now to offer his thoughts on what changes to these tax and estate planning provisions could mean for Americans. Greg, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me on, Dee.
Absolutely. So, Greg, on previous segments, we've talked about the provisions within the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, TCJA, expiring. But with the expiration coming up, can you explain to our listening audience why this expiration is so important?
Yes, Dee, of course. So former President Trump signed into law the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act while he was in office. And when it was implemented in 2017, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provided Americans with several substantial tax breaks. And since we hear on the news that many Americans are feeling financially exhausted after years of dealing first with the volatility of the stock market, then inflation, and now high interest rates, that paying those pre-Tax Cuts and Jobs Act tax rates could impact them and all Americans.
Now, Greg, with you saying that the changes to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act could affect Americans at every income level, it sounds like the TCJA is going to take center stage as the election gets closer. Does that depend on who wins the election if the TCJA will expire?
Well, there was a time when it was speculated that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act could be extended depending on who won the election. But today, nobody knows, but the country is just not the same as it was in 2017. Before the pandemic, the debt was running around $23 trillion. Now it's nearly $35 trillion and growing. So Congress can step in and make changes to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but because of the U.S. economic state, many financial professionals anticipate that regardless of who becomes, the next president, we'll likely see higher tax rates in the future. But we can't predict it, of course. We don't know what the future holds, but we need to be financially prepared either way. But I feel it's unlikely that they're going to be lower.
I want you to spend just a little bit of time just telling us what provisions within the TCJA will affect Americans the most if and when they expire.
Well, the stuff that is scheduled to expire, and again, just so we're clear, they'll expire unless there is, an act of Congress that will reinstate certain provisions. But the two most important, I feel, are the modifications to the actual tax rate, the table, and then the estate and gift taxes.
Okay, so let's discuss these provisions so listeners, as well as myself, can understand a little bit better how they could change. First, so what do listeners need to know about modifications to the tax rates?
Sure. So for taxpayers, tax rates are scheduled to revert back to the pre-Tax Cuts and Jobs Act levels. So as a result, whether you're an individual or a married couple, the tax rates will be higher, so you'll pay higher tax rates. Now, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act also increased the standard deductions from $13,000 in 2017 to $29,200 in 2024 for married couples, and for singles, it went from $6,500 to $14,600. And not only did they increase the standard deduction, these increases made it easier because a lot of Americans didn't need to itemize, but it allowed them to get more deduction because of those that weren't itemizing. So it also allowed more people to reduce their taxable income than the previous tax code allowed.
Okay, so Greg, this really sounds like it could impact a lot of American households. Now, can you remind us of the previous thresholds?
Yeah, so there's several tax brackets that are scheduled to revert back to the pre-Tax Cuts and Job levels. So this would increase federal taxes on average by about 3 to 4%. So if the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act reverts to the old rates, the brackets that we'll see increase are the ones that are currently 22% will go to 25%, 24% will go to roughly 28%, and 32% will go to 33%, and then the highest rate will increase from 37% to 39.6%.
Greg, as we previously mentioned, Americans are feeling financially strapped, and if the TCJA does in fact expire, what money moves can taxpayers make right now while America has historically low tax rates?
Well, as you know, Dee, everyone's house is different, but for many taxpayers, it could make sense to lock in historically low tax rates by converting you know, some of your pre-tax accounts, like your traditional IRAs, 401ks, to a Roth IRA. You know, and again, that's called a Roth conversion. So when you take existing money and roll it over or convert it into a Roth IRA, you pay the tax now at the ordinary rate, and then the money that is converted to the Roth grows tax-free until you withdraw it in retirement. So typically, when you withdraw the funds, you pay taxes at the tax rate in the year when you withdraw the money. This is why many professionals recommend a Roth, because many professionals anticipate higher future rates. So you pay the lower rate today instead of the higher rate by delaying those tax implications. So not only do Roth IRA owners not pay taxes on their withdrawals, but they neither do their heirs or those that inherit the Roth IRA.
Greg, so I'm not going to lie to you. As you were breaking it down, I kind of crossed my eyes because for me, it sounds just a little complicated. So I want to ask you, should someone consider talking to a financial professional like yourself at Hammer Financial Group if they want to get a complete Roth conversion?
Yes. And that's simply because, you know, the financial professional can guide you in the right direction. There's nothing intuitive about the IRS tax code. For example, taxpayers can complete multiple Roth conversions to a lower tax liability. Even further, taxpayers can still complete at least two annual Roth conversions, potentially saving thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in future taxes. And, you know, another example, you know, person who earns like $100,000 and wants to convert traditional IRA to Roth, and that account has $150,000, Do they do it 1 year or two? Because we still have this year and next year. So do we convert the entire 150, or do we look at converting 75 and 24 and then 75,000 and 25? So you might be able to stay at a lower rate doing that, less tax implication, and accomplish more depending on the timing of your conversion.
Greg, oftentimes taxpayers use charitable donations to offset their tax liability. And I mean, we hear at Lakeshore Public Media, we hear it all of the time with our sustaining members. Does a TCJA affect charitable donations?
Yeah, so the TCJA states that taxpayers who itemize the deduction for cash contributions to charity increased from the 50% of adjusted gross income to 60% of the adjusted gross income. So once it sunsets, it will revert back to the 50%. Remember also, people making a Roth conversion have to pay those taxes up front, even at our historically low tax rates. That could be a huge tax liability to pay at one time. So by doing large donations to a charity or a donor advised fund, you could offset that tax implication to create value. So something to think about is, you know, about 87% of Americans are currently taking the standard deduction, so they're not taking advantage of potential itemized deductions that you can get with charitable contributions.
Greg, great information as always, but I want to switch gears for just a moment to estate taxes. How does the TCJA sunsetting affect estates?
Yes, so it's another good question, because a lot of Americans are watching this provision closely. So the TCJA states that individuals can gift currently $13.6 million to heirs free of a federal estate tax. It's an estate taxes. This exemption is the highest it's ever been. If it sunsets, this exemption likely will be cut in half. But one thing taxpayers can do is give money to their heirs now while they're still alive, meaning before the exemption gets cut in half, and they can utilize that larger number. Also, the IRS has stated that there will be no clawback rule for outright gifts made before the TCJA expires. So this means that if gifts are made before the expiration and they were not taxable at the time of the gift because of the current provisions, then the heirs will never be taxed on them.
That is great information. Now, Greg, before I let you go, do you have any final words?
Yeah, I mean, don't wait till the last minute to discuss these options, because I tell people this is a calendar year that you might not want to slip by. So it's not about how much you earn. It's always about how much you get to keep. And if you don't have a plan in place, you could be taxed much more than you thought or need to be.
Greg Hammer is the president and CEO of Hammer Financial Group in Cherville. Greg, as always, we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we look forward to having you back with us next month.
Always a pleasure, Dee. Thanks.
A new series of laws took effect in Indiana on July 1st that introduced changes in the educational landscape. The legislative reforms impact important aspects of schooling, from literacy and work-based learning opportunities to religious instruction and student cell phone usage. We turn now to Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman, who will help unpack the 2024 Indiana legislative changes impacting all Indiana students. Tammy, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Dee. It's great to be back.
Absolutely. Tammy, this month's column focuses on new laws impacting students across the Hoosier State, again, that took effect on July 1st. And you open this month's column sharing that they impact important aspects from literacy retention to even cell phone usage. So let's start by breaking down Senate Bill 1, which tightens the state's policy for holding back and remediating young children who unfortunately don't demonstrate reading proficiency by third grade. Now, last month we discussed the 2024 Kids Count data book, which detailed that only one-third of Hoosier fourth grade students were reading at or above proficiency levels. Take a moment to talk about the impact this bill could have on school districts as well as youth-serving organizations moving forward.
Yes, and I so appreciate and thank you, Dee, for making that connection, right? Because we do know that several kids in our state and in our communities are struggling with reading. And so this bill is often called the Every Child Learns to Read bill, and it really does aim to help all students become proficient readers. So starting this school year, schools are required to hold back third graders, most third graders, let's be clear, who failed to pass the iRead state reading assessment. So there are some exemptions in there for English language learners, for students with IEPs, and possibly a couple other carve-outs. You know, I think one of the things that we're encouraged about is really paying attention to this third grade literacy. We hope that we hope that some of the other supportive measures that are taking place, and this law also does seek to increase the support for students with those foundational reading skills, such as extra tutoring or summer courses. You know, we hope that if those things work, no one will have to be held back.
Tammy, another hallmark piece of legislation that passed during the 2024 session that has caused quite a stir is Senate Enrolled Act 282, which addresses chronic truancy. Now, in your column, you note that nearly 1 in 5 Indiana students were chronically absent in 2023. And this new law compels more parental involvement and responsibility. Can you break down for our listening audience the response measures school districts will be required to adhere to?
Yes. So chronic truancy, and I think habitually truant is one of those terms that some folks don't understand. It's hard to understand if you don't hear it repeatedly. And those are students with 10 or more unexcused absences within a school year. And so now schools must report those habitually truant students to the prosecutor's office. And there could be some legal action. Again, you know, I think we're seeing those absentee rates after the pandemic and before the pandemic, and we know it's a challenge. Again, we hope that by raising awareness and by engaging, hopefully no one will have to have any sort of legal action. I think part of the intent is just to shine a light on it, to raise it up and make sure that we're, you know, consistently saying kids need to be in school in order to learn effectively.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought up the pandemic, because you think about over the last few years, as we continue to recover from the pandemic, sadly, educators were kind of put to blame, I guess, if you will, for lower testing scores in the classroom. But I just want to note for our listening audience an important quote that I heard from an educator who said that we can't teach the students if they're not in the classroom. And so I think that's sort of the genesis of this bill, correct?
Correct. You're still right. And I also think, you know, families, it was pretty confusing when we were first coming out of the pandemic. When do you keep your students home? When do you send them to school? You know, and rightfully so, at that time, they were coached to be abundantly cautious and keep your students home because of safety reasons, obviously. Well, when did that change? And how do we then get back into the habit of making sure that kids are going nearly all the time, unless there's some big reason that they can't attend? So I think it really was a challenging time for teachers and families. Hopefully, again, we all get back on the same page. Kids need to go to school so that they can learn. They need to be there almost every day, certainly every day that they can be. You know, I think it'll be better for students. It'll be better for teachers. And it'll be better for the state long term.
Now, Tammy, another measure you address in your latest column, 2024 legislative changes impacting Indiana students, and it's one that I'm so glad you do detail in your article, is a bill to expand Indiana college credit and degree options. Speak more to this new bill and how it will help ease student debt, which I think is so critical right now, as well as help more Hoosier students earn credentials.
Yes. And so we know the Indiana Commission for Higher Education assesses us all the time. And we know that through them, dual credit earners are more likely to stay in college and complete college either on time or early. And so in addition to the cost savings, it also is this motivation and propellant forward. So Indiana high schools are required to offer Indiana College Core by this school year, the 2024-2025 academic year, or have a plan to do so the following year, so that every student can earn 30 credit hours of college-level coursework that is transferable to any Indiana public college or university. So again, we're preparing kids for college, we're saving them money, and hopefully we're adding that motivation that will help get them to and through their post-secondary learning choice.
Finally, Tammy, your latest column, which can be found at IYI.org, by the way, for our listening audience, details all of the 2024 legislative changes that impact all Hoosier students. But I want to talk about another education bill you unpack in your latest column, SEA, or Senate Enrolled Act 185, which focuses on cell phone use restrictions. And this is a hot one because, well, teachers, of course, were raising their hands saying yes, yes, yes. There were some parents that were kind of on the fence about it, largely concerned about their students' safety. So I want to ask you, do you believe this new law will improve student engagement, behavior, and mental health as lawmakers intended to?
Well, I think, first of all, you're right to call it a hot topic. We're seeing a lot of discussion about this. Second of all, time will tell. I do know, you know, we're continuing to have these discussions, and I think this piece of legislation is right in the middle of it, talking about what is healthy practice in technology use. And we know that there are some things that are very common sense, and that we know that technology can be quite beneficial for educational purposes and those emergencies that you're talking about. At the same time, that we know that kids who are maybe, you know, sitting with their phones under their desk and paying attention to their phones or what's buzzing or whatever, instead of engaging in the coursework, that can be detrimental to learning. So we're trying to say, you know, each school, this requires transparency and consistency across school districts, and schools need to publish their policies online. And I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see some schools trying a couple things and then having to rethink and try something new and work with it for a little while. The goal is really to find what is that healthy balance of safety and positive technology use, and then when does it become time to turn it off and fully focus on the classroom?
I wholeheartedly agree. As the mom of two that are still in high school, I know firsthand not only the distraction that it causes regarding kids looking on social media or whatever, but sometimes there's a lot of drama that surrounds cell phone usage and things spread so easily. So I for one, believe that this is at least a great start to get the conversation going and get students to realize that, hey, it's not a necessity to have a cell phone in the classroom. Put it down, stay focused, stay engaged, and listen to your teacher.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would even say, you know, it's good as all of us as adults model that behavior as well.
Absolutely. I agree. So, Tammy, I think you just told me to put my cell phone down.
Well, no, I'm saying it probably for myself as well. I'm certainly guilty of it. And again, I think it's really how do we model, teach, and enforce those healthy uses and then acknowledge that that's not all the time.
Absolutely. Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of Indiana Youth Institute. You can get all of the details on all of the bills that will affect education for all of our Hoosier students by visiting IYI.org. Tammy, again, I thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we look forward to having you back with us next month.
I look forward to it as well. Thanks so much, Steve.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests from North Shore Health Center's Gervais Dickerson, Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman, and Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. And we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.